This is Car Expert.
You can't really blame Subaru for saying, well, you know, if you guys don't want to buy sedans anymore, then stuff that we won't offer them.
So you actually have more pixels in your headlights than you do in most TVs.
I worry about the actual Discovery itself. To me, this thing supersedes it.
Now, if the Toyota RAV4 was just a car brand in and of itself, it would have been the number three car brand in the market.
G'day, my name is Mandy Turner, and this week I'm joined by Mike Costello.
Hey, Mandy.
And Tony Grandpa Crawford.
Yeah, I really don't want that name, Mandy. I just want to be Tony.
Sorry,
can we call you Pop?
Yeah, isn't it? It feels so odd.
Hey, congratulations, though. That's really exciting.
Yeah, no, it's really good. Jordan's 28. She's my oldest. She is good. The grandson was born two days ago, 16-hour labor, 3 kilos and 10, 3.10. Yeah, his name is Jacob with a K, and apparently that's Swedish because the father's mother is from Sweden and the father's father is from Ireland. He's about 6'2", and the brother's about 6'4", and looks like an actual Viking. I could just imagine him with one of those giant Viking axes chasing someone through the Swedish forest, and I'd be running like hell.
Can you already tell he's going to have those Tony genes of talking with his hands?
I don't know. I hope he gets Jordan's brains and not mine.
Well, I got to say, Crawford, you've been putting the lie to that statement this week in terms of brain power, because you've been, well, down here in Melbourne, you know, Mandy and myself and Paulie and Scott and James and all the team, we've not been able to drive. And so it's fallen to your good self to basically single-handedly carry the entire editorial team for the past week. You've reviewed, what, 4 cars in the past week, I believe, because every car launch has been moved to Sydney, basically.
It has. And that, I was just reading, and I just don't know how I did that because I wrote 4 reviews in 3 days and I've got the Ignis, the little Suzuki Ignis, still to be published. That one I wrote on the Monday, and then I wrote 3 more and they were quite long reviews. And anyway, look, I got through it. It was a one all-nighter, and I actually did another semi-all-nighter last night to finish the Yaris SX Hybrid. Another car I'm very impressed with. We won't talk about that now. We've got other stuff to talk about.
Usually cars like that send you to sleep, not keep you awake. Yeah. What's happening?
It's Toyota, and I Edward Scissorhands must have edited the review on the Yaris because I read it this morning and a little bit was taken out. A little bit was taken out, and it was about – in 2013, I was at the Nürburgring with Aston Martin for the race, and Dr. Betts, I'd become quite close to him and his wife, and I was invited to dinner with him, his wife, and Akio and his entourage.
And so this is Dr. Betts, the former boss of Aston Martin, and Akio Toyota, the head of Toyota.
Yes, and I was quite shocked. We were in the Piston Klaus, I think, Sabine Schmidt's parents' place at the ring, where everyone seems to go. And it's an amazing place full of posters and pictures of race cars and famous racing drivers and all that. And anyway, he was telling me then, before he started to get into the shots, I better not say too much. I feel like I might even be treading in dangerous water saying that. But anyway, like, he was talking about making Toyotas interesting and fun to drive. I think those are the words that he used. Mm. And it's pretty right, because I tell you what, driving – I drove the first Echo, which was the first generation Yaris. And that was just a heap of shit. Oh, sorry. That was a pretty bad car. And I thought nothing of that. And I don't think I'd driven a Yaris since. And that would be like 2001.
Wow. Okay, that's...
Climbing. And when one of the guys said that I needed to, you know, review the Yaris Hybrid, and I thought, oh my god, this is going to be painful. But I was right from the get-go. I like the shape. I like what they've done with it. It's a tough little sort of you know, sort of performance orientated looking things, but especially the hybrid. Mm. And the interior is amazing. Have you guys been in one yet?
No.
Oh, well, they're not really doing press cars down here, unfortunately, but we've been following it pretty closely. And obviously, it's a big step up in price, but it looks to be a big step up in everything else too. So definitely looking forward to having a crack down here.
Yeah, it's a game changer, that one. It's got some amazing kit in it, and the style of the two little sort of cylinders that are actual digital gauges, and they pop out from a central display screen. It's just a fantastic car to drive, though. That's the thing. It rides well. And for a small car to really soak up the bumps, it's not that easy to do. Not many ride that well. Peugeot might be the exception, but I was incredibly impressed. But, look, I could go for an hour on that. But you're right, Moco, the price could be a deal breaker because it's a huge increase from where you could get into a Yaris the previous gen for about 16 drive away. Now you're kicking off at almost 23 plus on roads. And the Yaris that I had, the SX hybrid CVT, I think it was 29,500 plus on road. So you got to
have Albors as bank balance to be able to afford a Yaris.
Well, you do, and the reason it took me ages to finish that review is the pricing. I really dived into what you could buy for the same money, and you can get for the top spec ZR. You can get a Polo GTI. It's got almost double the torque, and we all know what that is. And that's also got all the safety kit. Moco, you know that the Yaris is the new Yaris has got a bunch of world first for that segment, in that turn directional, what's that thing it's called, intersection turn assist, I think, and it's got something else that's a world first for the category, for the light car category. So they've thrown everything in the kitchen sink at it. I just don't know whether people are going to be able to pay that sort of money for a light car.
Well, we're going to get you talking about the Land Rover Defender a little bit later on in the show, Tony, but we're just going to get you to step out for about 15 minutes or so. We'll bring Paul Marrick in to talk about car news, which is next. Here is this week's car news, and we start off with some sad news, Moco, about Subaru Australia axing an iconic model.
Yeah, so the Subaru Liberty, or known as the Legacy in most other markets around the world, is no more for Australia. So 31 years since the first one arrived in 1989, six generations, both sedan and wagon body styles offered for most of the history, although the wagon was discontinued for the previous gen. But no more. I mean, it's no secret here that SUVs are where it's at now when it comes to sales, and Subaru is pretty well covered with Forester and Outback, and it just doesn't think that it can sell Liberty sedans and wagons anymore. And it's still being made overseas for markets like the United States, but not for us. So pretty sad. There was a time there where the Subaru Liberty was really at its peak, probably with the fourth generation car, with those frameless doors and the turbo boxer engines and the all-wheel drive. And it was a pretty iconic car there, and I think it's one of those cars that most of us probably have some experience with. I know I used to work at a Subaru dealer back in the day for a while, and that was during the era of the Gen 4 car, and I used to love getting behind the wheel of it. So a real shame that it's moved on.
It is a shame, because I remember we actually did a comparison back at the old place between the six-cylinder against the Calais.
The Calais, VF2, I think it was. Yeah, you and I went out to the boonies. Yeah. And
so I guess it shows you that it's, it had its place there in the large sedan market, but, you know, as the rest of large sedans, they have all just gradually disappeared.
You know, and it had, you know, the RS Turbo was a massive sort of classic on the rally scene in the early 90s as well, when Subaru used to be all over the rally stuff. It won a couple of Car of the Year titles from a few relatively well-known media organizations over the journey as well, so a pretty beloved car.
I was just going to ask you whether you knew of the sales figures for that car.
So it sold more than 153,700 over the generations. So huge numbers, although just lately it's completely fallen off a cliff. So just lately the Outback's outselling at about 7-1. So the market basically spoke. And you can't really blame Subaru for saying, well, you know, if you guys don't want to buy sedans anymore, then stuff it, we won't offer them.
That's quite sad. Do you have any memories of the Liberty, Paul?
No, look, I mean, I grew up with, you know, Commodores and Falcon, but it was more the Outback that was popular when I was younger. The Liberty, like Moko said, was kind of a bit of a specialist vehicle, but all-wheel drive, it was, you know, Subaru's motif there with all-wheel drive was always leading the pack there. But I don't know, it just never really stood out, and I think that seems to have translated now to these large sedans where it's just not of interest to people.
Yeah.
There was that period in the early 2000s where Japanese sedans were killing it. There was the fourth gen Liberty, which was the best of the bunch. There was the first Honda Accord Euro. And then there was that first Mazda 6 as well. There was that brief period where Japanese sedans were like the best cars you could buy for that sort of 30 or 40 grand mark. But that didn't last very long.
Well, the one car that Australia is obsessed with at the moment, SUVs. And Paul, Jeep have revealed a concept of what the Grand Wagoneer will look like.
How cool is this thing? Where do I start? So Wagoneer is effectively going to be a product line for Jeep, so it's going to be their luxury cars. If you don't know what a Grand Wagoneer is, if you've ever watched Breaking Bad, it's the car that Skyler drove around in with the wood paneling on the side. And it's got a lot of heritage, and it was always the duck's nuts of Jeep products, the Grand Wagoneer. And they've come back to that, and this car has been delayed that many times. It was first meant to be released, I think, in 2013. It was then delayed to 2015, eventually pushed back to 2019. Then COVID hit. It was meant to be released this year. And now all we're seeing is a concept. But we do know that it will begin production next year, and it's likely to look virtually the same as the concept. It's based on the Ram 1500 platform, so it shares a platform with that vehicle. It'll come in plug-in hybrid in addition to probably V6 and V8 petrol engines. Now, I guess you're wondering, Mandy, I could hear you just about to ask this, where is the wood in this car? Well,
you know me too well.
Yeah, funny you should ask. It's actually in the headlights. They're framed really? With teak wood. It's really cool. I don't know if that's just for the concept or if it'll stay. And they've gone to town on LED lighting. Like, there is LED lighting all over this car. And something that we first saw in the Taycan, which is a screen for the passenger. The interior is really luxe.
Yeah, that's cool. Okay, so I'm assuming, Paul, you're a fan, but I know this car has split the car expert office. What do you think about it, Moko?
Oh, I love it. I don't understand any of the polarization. I mean, look, big yank tank SUVs like Chevy Tahoe and Ford Expedition and this don't really float my boat typically. And to be honest with you, I think most people that own them don't need anything quite so ludicrously oversized. But in terms of design, it's awesome. It looks, I mean, clearly this concept car is pretty much road ready because it doesn't have that crazy conceptness to it. Like, it's got functional door handles and wheels and lights and all those things. It looks fantastic. Quintessentially American.
Mandy, I now that Moko likes it, I should probably hate it. I don't really want to be aligned with him on anything.
It's very rare that we agree on things, Paulie, but I think in this instance we just might. I think, oh, man, it looks good. But one thing I can't work out is the new Ram 1500 pickup truck is not made in right-hand drive by FCA. Re-engineered in Australia by a third party. Is there any chance of this being made in right hook for markets like ours?
I don't know. You would genuinely hope so, because it would have broad appeal, and I think that you could sell something like that here comfortably if people want to spend money on it. But that also leads to the question, well, yeah, how are you going to engineer it? This has independent front and rear suspension, so it's going to be dynamically very different to the Ram 1500. But fundamentally, if you're going to change one platform, you could probably go ahead and change two. So perhaps down the track, we may even see the next generation of the Ram 1500 in right-hand drive as well. So I don't know. It's built in Detroit, Michigan. And the cool thing is the roof actually has an outlined map of Detroit etched into it, which is pretty sweet, I reckon.
Very nice. And, Moko, we've got all the details this week for the 2021 Mercedes-Benz S-Class.
Yeah, a new S-Class is always a big deal, isn't it? Pretty evolutionary in terms of design. It's smoother, it's rounder, it's got flush-fitting doors, a bit like Paulie's Tesla. But, you know, it hardly moves the dial too much with styling. It's got a coefficient of drag of just 0.22, so it's extraordinarily aerodynamic for a big car. But obviously an S-Class wouldn't be an S-Class without a whole suite of sort of model-leading or brand-leading, I should say, technology. So it's got, first of all, these amazing headlights that can project warning signs onto the road. And the headlight units have 1.3 million micro mirrors in them and 2.6 million effective pixels, which to my non-engineer brain doesn't really compute, but anything that's involving 1.3 million micro mirrors sounds really, really complicated. It's got this huge landscape screen inside, so it's a bit of a different look for the Mercedes interiors, with 3D imaging on it, and it's also got an augmented reality head-up display. So you've seen in some Mercedes-Benzes, they've got augmented reality arrows that overlay live footage of what's ahead of you on the center screen for sort of real-world mapping, but now it's moved to the head-up display, so it's actually project onto the windscreen ahead of you. It's got an evolved version of the Hey Mercedes voice-controlled MBUX system. It's got a camera inside it that checks that you're wearing your seatbelt and politely asks you to put it on if you're not. It's got front seats with 19 motors in them to control all the different massage functions. It's got this fluid system, sort of like arteries in the body, that goes around the car and changes the amount of fluid in each damper depending on which corner needs extra sort of damping. It's called supportive hydro pneumatics for the air suspension. A camera reads the road ahead and adjusts the active cruise control on the suspension to suit the bumps. It's got airbags in the rear seats ahead of the passengers. It's got LiDARs in it, so it's capable of level 3 autonomous driving once the software goes out over the air, once it's legalized in certain domains. And in terms of engines, it's going to have inline 6 petrols and diesels to begin with. I assume there'll be V8s to follow. There always is. But the interesting one for me is the plug-in hybrid. So it's going to have a 100-kilometer pure electric range from the FEV, which as far as I know is probably the world record for a FEV. No full EV that I know of, because Mercedes-Benz is simultaneously working on a car called EQS, which is kind of the electric S-Class, which will have a 700k range. So I think they're leaving the pure EV to that, but kind of evolutionary in some ways. I think the days of the S-Class kind of having 100 features on it that no other Benz has are probably gone. But, you know, this is a car that the more you look at it, I guess the more complex and interesting it gets. So have you had a good look at it, Paulie? What do you think?
Yeah, I actually just have a fun thing there on the headlights, the digital lights. When you mentioned the 2.6 million effective pixels, to put that into comparison, a matrix LED, and if you've had a look at our headlight comparison, we kind of go into a bit of detail on how all these headlights work, but a matrix LED that's fitted to the car as standard has 84 LED modules and it's 84 pixels in terms of the quality you can get with it. With those digital lights, 2.6 million pixels as a comparison, a TI-83 graphics calculator, which a lot of people used in high school, has 6,000 pixels. A HD TV has around 2 million pixels. So you actually have more pixels in your headlights than you do in most TVs. The other cool thing is that it gets a constant video stream from a graphics card, and it's able to project images onto the road. So if you're in a roadwork zone, it'll project an image of an excavator out onto the road. It's just fascinating stuff. And you know, I feel with this car, the design, I don't know, isn't amazing. I think I'll have to wait till I see it in person. But I'll be keen to see where they go with the S-Class. I don't know. Is it still popular around the world, or is it just in Australia that it's sort of...
Yeah, look, it's still... I mean, last time I looked into it, it was massive in China. So that's the real hub market for it now. You know, most of the world is sort of moving towards more SUVs and EVs as well for their flagships. But I think the S-Class for Mercedes, it's half vehicle but half marketing tool, because for as long as the brand's been around, some iteration of the big sedan has been its premium vehicle, and the S-Class name's been around for a long time. And it's hard to imagine an S-Class not coming out every couple of years with a whole bunch of new features for the brand. It's sort of almost expected at this point. What was interesting about this car was you sort of expect to see a new S-Class and for it to just completely blow you away, whereas I think this one's a bit more of a grower. A lot of that tech, and Paula, you just illustrated it beautifully, is that a lot of the tech's actually on the face of it, not that revolutionary, but the deeper you dig, the more really incredible stuff that you sort of find, almost like hidden Easter eggs. I'm kind of curious about this idea of projecting stuff onto the road ahead. I'm not really sure whether that's just a novelty or whether there's going to be actually use for that.
Well, it basically uses the three sort of very strong LEDs that are then fed that digital image. But I think what I've heard previously, I think from Audi, is that this – no, it was from Mercedes-Benz. The idea of projection was to actually potentially alert other drivers that you are in an autonomous mode, for example. So you can – or even if there's a hazard up ahead – you can imagine there's this sort of uses for this technology, but I think it'll evolve over time. It's sort of something that they've just released, and I'll be keen to see where they go with it. But yeah, it's interesting.
And lastly, Paul, a story that's just gone live. For some people who might not know, you have a Tesla.
Yes.
And you bought a Model 3 and a Toyota Supra last year, and you've just recently got the prices on the resale values. What did you end up finding?
So I did a story on this just because I was just curious about it. So the recommended retail price of these two cars, I bought a Toyota Supra GTS and then a Model 3 Performance. The recommended retail price of those two cars was around $3,000 to $4,000 apart. Both of those had options added to them, so I added a performance upgrade to the Model 3 Performance and the white interior, and then also Alcantara interior and matte grey paint for the Supra. And the final price of those two was around $7,000 apart. Now, the Supra was limited in Australia to around 350 vehicles. And the Model 3, from what we can tell, Tesla doesn't share sales data, but for the Model 3, we can tell they've sold around 3,000 cars in Australia. So I thought, well, let me go to the second-hand market and just see how these cars have depreciated and what they're worth. And I was pretty shocked, if I'm honest. So the Supra, I looked at two sources for depreciation. One was certified used vehicles. Both Tesla and Toyota run a certified used program where they look over the car before it gets sort of allowed to be sold through Toyota as a certified used car. And then I had a look at private used cars, which was through car sales. So the Supra, through the certified used program, has depreciated almost 21% in the matter of a year. The Tesla, through the certified used program, has depreciated 10.1%. Now, the caveat here, both for the Tesla and the Supra, is the Tesla, they only had one car that was sold through the certified used program this year, and that car didn't have the performance upgrade or the white interior, so there was a price difference of around $8,000 between what it sold for and what mine was worth, which would account for the difference there. And same story with the Supra. A lot of those cars weren't matte grey or didn't have the Alcantara, so there would have been a difference of around $5,000. But when you went to the private used market, the Supra was slightly less hurt at 14.9% average, and the Model 3 Performance actually appreciated in value on the used car market by 2%. So it's interesting. I've deduced here that my rationale behind these sort of depreciation values and them being so bad on the Supra is because Toyota made the announcement that they'll be upgrading the Supra every 12 months. And as part of that, we'll be bringing more power and hardware changes, the first of which we see this year. And I think that's really affecting them, because why would someone now buy that car if they know that within 12 months it will be worth less? And why would you then just keep chasing that game with Toyota? Whereas with Tesla, I've had probably 10 software updates over the year that I've owned the car, and they all bring new features, more efficiency, all this sort of stuff that just I didn't pay for and just comes free of charge.
So, Paulie, what kind of stuff have you added to your Tesla this year? Can you give us some examples?
Yep. So they improved the efficiency of the motors. So we had, I think, a 5% or 10% increase in range. They also improved the acceleration off the line. So they were both sort of software updates that came through. So they affected the driving performance. In terms of actual features, there's just been a litany of things. They added, over the past 12 months, Netflix. They added DAB Plus digital radio. They added a 360-degree camera function. They also added a track mode that allowed you to adjust the torque distribution around the car and the stability control intervention, along with additional cooling if you do take it to the track. They've added all sorts of incremental updates, such as improvements to voice recognition and the ability for it to use the cloud for analyzing it. There's just a long list of stuff that all these random little things that they add and improve over time that I wasn't expecting to begin with, but have just been added free of charge. And
that literally just happens almost without you even knowing it, right? It's just the car just downloads it at your leisure when it's parked, yeah. And then you start it up the next day and it has that feature.
Yeah, exactly, right? The car's parked in my bay here at the apartment. I have a Wi-Fi sort of adapter on our charging unit, so it just pulls the update overnight, applies the update, and Bob's your uncle. I think actually the most useful update was both Sentry mode and dash cams. So they started using, the car has 8 cameras around it. They used 4 of those cameras to permanently record when the car's driving as a dash cam. So you have front, rear, and the sides. But the Sentry mode was the most useful because it'll record motion around the car. If someone approaches the car, it'll record all the cameras. And if someone damages the car, you have all that footage there that no one else can have access to.
Yeah, well, no wonder it's appreciating then.
So, Paul, what do you have planned for these two cars? For someone who's going to hold on to these for a long time, I suppose resale value doesn't really matter. So is this going to impact the time that you're going to have these cars for?
Look, with the Supra, I'll probably sell that soonish. Just given the way the depreciation's going, I don't really want to be there when it hits 50, 60, 70%. And I just don't drive it. It's just disappointing that, well, I mean, we can't really avoid it, but the whole situation at the moment with coronavirus means there's no track days. There's sort of little point having it sitting there gathering dust. So with the Tesla, though, we drive that all the time. My wife drives it to and from work, and it's just the easier car to live with. So, yeah, I don't know. We'll see what happens. But, it's just interesting. I didn't expect this, and it was just fascinating to see how these two cars have differed so much. Despite the fact that the reason I use both of these is because both of those weren't available in Australia when they first went on sale. So it wasn't like there was a precedent, and both were around the same price. So I thought it'd be interesting to see how they fared.
You can let us know your thoughts. You can email podcast@carexpert.com.au, and you can also head to the site to read up on all of these stories that we've discussed. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about all the details of the all-new 2021 Isuzu D-Max, but we couldn't talk about how it drove until now. Paul was the first to get behind the wheel, and this week he's reviewing the top-spec X Terrain. So, Paul, it's been a while since the D-Max has been called all new. Was it actually worth the wait?
Yes, and let me caveat a couple of things here, Mandy, because I know that people will have these questions on their mind potentially. We actually performed this review across 2 states. Now, the reason for that is Melbourne went into a draconian stage 4 lockdown shortly after we received this car, so it meant that our ability to drive it across our standard testing regime was slightly limited, which is why I did a lot of the urban driving and a little bit of highway driving, and then Will Stopford up in Brisbane did some of the other aspects. We do plan on getting the car back for towing and also load hauling as well, but I digress. So the X-Terrain sits at the very top of the D-Max tree. It's a new variant for the brand. Previously, it used to top out, I think, at the LST, which was the top spec, and that means that prices have climbed. And they've climbed quite a way here. So they do a driveway offer at the moment of $58,990 for the top specification X-Terrain, and the entire range starts with the SX for $29,990 driveway. But the retail prices of this car are $62,900 for the X-Terrain, which means it is expensive when you look at how it compares to previous generations of the D-Max. But like all D-Maxes, they always do driveway pricing that makes them slightly better. Now, when you say all new, this is very much all new. It no longer shares a platform with any other brands except Mazda, which is now piggybacking off the back of the D-Max. And that means they've been able to get a little creative in terms of the features they're fitting to the car. They've gone to town in terms of also fitting extra technology such as wireless Apple CarPlay and Android Auto to a big 9-inch screen in the center. It comes with all the latest safety bells and whistles as well. And most importantly, the engine is all new. It's codenamed the Ford JJ3. It's an evolution of the Ford JJ1, which is one of the most reliable vehicles in this segment. And it is powered by a 3-litre version of that engine that produces 140 kilowatts of power and 450 newton metres of torque. So it is a pretty impressive package, I reckon.
Paul, still a fair bit of hard plastics in the cabin, I'm probably looking at the LSU, I think, that variant. Is that right?
No, absolutely not. This is probably the best interior in the segment. Even with the LSU trim inside the cabin, you're still getting all of those soft touch finishes atop the dashboard. The doors align nicely. The center console's nice and soft. We often talk about these things because, you know, no one really in the ownership of a car will go and touch the dashboard and go, oh, look, it's a soft touch dashboard. But it's more a perception thing. If you jump into this car, you've got friends or family that are in the car, they notice these things. And when you sit in the D-Max compared to something like the Hilux, for example, this feels like a much more premium and better finished interior.
They are. They're, look, I'll give you the fact that it is a very good looking vehicle from the outside, at least. I really like those rear taillight assembly. They're really quite interesting, those lights. I wonder how it's going to sell with that price rise and the fact that you can still buy the Triton GLS for $10,000 less.
Yeah, the Triton is probably a different proposition. It doesn't quite have the features that this vehicle has. Yes, it is expensive, but if you actually have a look at the comparison to stuff like the SR5 Plus, in fact, Moco did a comparison article there with the cross-section of these top-end utes. And Moco, I think you'll agree that it is actually competitively priced when you look at it compared to those competitors.
Yeah, man, totally. 59 drive away. And up against a Wild Tracker and SR5 Plus, it absolutely stacks up. What's really interesting to me is the old D-Maxes were always just an engine and really not a lot else. People bought them because they were reliable, but you hopped inside one and it did feel like going back in time a little bit. Whereas this new one has sort of completely reversed that. They're not relying on being cheap and rugged and hose out anymore. And even if, as Crawford says, the interior may not be quite luxury SUV-like, it is 400,000 times more advanced than the predecessor model. Like, it's very rare to see such a big change in vehicles over the course of one generation.
I think the biggest thing for me was how well this car rides. Often you look at these dual cab utes and certainly we learned from the previous generation of Hilux that they're just quite firm and agricultural when you're not using them for the purpose of being a dual cab ute. And unfortunately, these days, a lot of people don't use these for work. They'll use them as a leisure vehicle and perhaps for a bit of work during the week. So Isuzu spent a fair bit of effort in tuning the ride to make sure that it actually is nice and compliant, especially in and around the city. The steering is light enough and easy to use in terms of parking. And, I mean, the engine's interesting because 450 newton metres is less than the leaders in the segment at 500, but it's quite a decent torque spread. So when you actually get stuck into it, it feels like it's not working as hard and you can just lean on that torque band to get the most out of it. You don't feel like you're having to ask too much from the engine. And the gearbox is the same. It's just always in the right gear. It's just really pleasant to drive. In terms of the stuff I didn't like, I guess, if we look at some of the cons here, there's no auto-dimming rear vision mirror, only a minor thing, but can get a little frustrating over time. The engine's still fairly noisy, so when you are leaning on the throttle, it can be a little intrusive from the outside and also inside the cabin. And while the infotainment system's great in terms of the smartphone mirroring stuff, it can be a little bit fiddly to use when you aren't sort of in those smartphone mirroring menus.
Yeah, I noticed you're a little bit derogatory towards the Hilux the beginning of this conversation. And I happen to have a fairly long drive, few hundred Ks at least, in the new Hilux Workmate. I was incredibly surprised. I've never liked Hiluxes. For that reason, I thought they rode terribly and almost make you sick with the amount of bumping and busyness of that suspension. But this new one in the Workmate, which I believe is base spec almost, if not the base spec, the ride comfort across B roads in central New South Wales was quite excellent. And I compared notes with another journo that arrived at this event in a slightly higher spec trim. And he also compared notes with me and was also impressed with the way it dealt with bumps and the way it sort of absorbed most of the broken roads that it went over. So, you know, it had radar cruise, for instance, which was great.
Yeah, I was pretty impressed with that. The latest Hilux has a completely different suspension tune. So, and they needed that because the last one was just terrible.
I think this is really what you're seeing is the response to Ranger, because the Aussie engineered T6 Ranger, when it came out, really did move the game forward. I mean, it got electric assisted power steering that was so light you could use a pinky to turn the wheel. It had that leaf suspension, but it was beautifully compliant, drives like an SUV, you know, acoustic glass, very, very car-like as far as utes go. And you've seen now its biggest rivals all following suit. So they're realizing that, you know, in the case of the Hilux, yeah, there might be someone who drives it who's carrying around 800 kilos in the back all the time, but the vast majority, they're using it as a family, a second family car. So yeah, other brands have really sort of woken up, I guess, to that importance.
Yeah, and Moco, I just want to point out that I was driving that with an empty bed, empty tray. And again, the ride was very, very good. What I was also pretty impressed with is you talk about a noisy engine in the D-Max. The Hilux at sitting at 110 k's an hour was barely ticking over and was very quiet inside the cabin. And the radar cruise just worked a treat. I was pretty much stunned. If this was the base model, and from what I was speaking with the other guy who had the SR5, said there really wasn't a lot of difference between the two, which I thought was odd too.
Well, I'm looking forward to this big pickup comparison test that we'll be doing down in Victoria once we're allowed to leave our house for more than an hour a day. The very, very, very first priority that we have is getting all of these new utes together at a 4x4 park and going to town on them. So just a couple of weeks left to go.
Do you think they're going to get even more luxury? Do you think we'll just see this trend keep going with more and more luxury features added to it and, you know, better seats? And do you think it's just going to keep going where these vehicles are genuinely used as a one vehicle family family car by a tradie, for instance, during the week and then on the weekends? We've always talked about that, but does it really happen?
You've only got to look at America, don't you? I mean, have a look at the top Ram 1500s and top F-150s and things from Ford. They're super luxury. You get in like an F-150 Lariat or something and it leaves a top-of-the-range Ranger for dead. So, look, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. Interesting.
Paul, before you go.
Yes.
A couple of weeks ago you gave us a bit of a tease. We're going to move on from utes now. You said you've got a really great story about an Audi S8 and you said, I'll tell you about it one day.
Yes.
Can I ask you about this now?
Yes, you can. And I'm just trying to cast my memory back to when this was. I'm almost certain it was, I think, 2 years ago, maybe 2.5 years ago. We did a tour of the Audi factory in, now let me just get the spelling of this right.
Was it Neckar Sulum?
Yes, there it is. There we go. Yes, it is. So it's basically the factory where they build a great deal of Audi's vehicles, including the A8. And it was just cool because they do delivery there. So a lot of people will come and pick up their cars and they do factory tours and all that kind of thing. Anyway, we were doing a tour of this factory and we were having a look at all these A8s and we're just walking along and I had a look at one of them and I'm like, that's interesting. That one has four exhaust pipes. And this was before the new A8 was released. And I was having a look and I thought, that's really fascinating. And it ended up being the S8. And the reason it was a dead giveaway that it was the S8, aside from the four exhaust pipes, was there was all these people standing underneath it. So they had this huge factory, production lines of all these cars moving around the place. The new A8 was coming down the production line. They were showing us how it all worked. And the only car that had like a crowd of bystanders looking at stuff underneath it was the S8 prototype. So this was a car that they obviously sent down the production line to test tooling and to get everything set up. So we thought at the time then that that meant this car was probably 6 months away, and it was quite fascinating to see that that car was only recently released and more so only recently released to Australia. So we got a very early preview some two and a half years ago of a car that we weren't really meant to see.
Wow. So you obviously weren't allowed to talk about it, write about it, or anything like that.
And they wouldn't confirm what it was, but we clearly could see that it had four exhaust pipes and, you know, it had a different design to it and all these people were sort of looking at it and all this sort of stuff. So it was really cool to see that back then. And I think it goes to show you that they actually actually worked quite a way in advance, and they obviously spent a fair bit of time getting this car right and getting the dynamics right. So, yeah.
I think the thing with A8 styling is it could have been one of the last five generations and you wouldn't have been able to tell the difference.
Well, Moco, there is only four generations.
Oh, no, I've run into the authority on all things Audi A8.
I was going to say, talk Ute and has no idea, but talk the Audi A8 and whoa.
I love the Audi A8. It's a superb car, but it's definitely an example of Audi's evolutionary design, isn't it? They kind of do tend to look a bit similar.
Yeah, and you got to think about the market for these things. Like, seriously, who's buying a 5.2-metre Audi S8 for their daily? I mean, you know, it's obviously not a chauffeur's car because you'd buy a standard A8. So who's buying the S8?
You never know.
It's got to be a very small market, but it is, for a 5.2-metre behemoth, it is a remarkably agile, high-performance car that can be driven in twisties, as it were, a hot hatch, and with an engine sound above 3,500 that is just glorious, you know. And, you know, it's always been the techno tour de force, hasn't it, for Audi? And in the same way that S-Class is for Mercedes and 7 Series for BMW. So they throw everything at it. And hopefully, if enough people buy them, it trickles down into, you know, A-Classes and, you know, X2s and X1s and all that sort of stuff so that we all can enjoy. And it takes those people to shell out 260 grand so that people that shell out 30 or 40 grand can get that same kit.
Exactly. Well, I'm going to bid you guys farewell. I'm going to leave Tony in your very capable hands. Good luck to you all.
Thanks.
Yeah, I wonder if I'm hoping you're going off to get that other podcast up, Paul.
Yeah, all I need now is the stuff that you guys promised to send me and it'll all be ready.
Would that be our boss from this morning? He's been busy doing, I don't know what he does all day, but it's
one of the world's greatest mysteries.
It's a great mystery. He's either driving his Ferrari or his Lambo, or he's at the track with Atco.
Or he's posting pics of his new house as it's being built.
Yeah, that's right. One place he's not is at his desk.
Tony, it's almost as strange as you talking about Utes, Elbors, and yeah.
I do like you, Paul. I had a very good feeling in that Hilux.
If they were allowing domestic flights in any great degree at the moment, I'd insist on you coming down to help Paulie, Mandy and I with the Ute mega test in Melbourne, because I would love to,
Moco. I would be wearing my Stetson and my boots.
R.M. Williams boots.
Yeah, no, heaven forbid, mate. Heaven forbid. These are boots from Texas, mate. Lucadia boots. These are Italian craftsmanship from 1825.
Are they American or are they Italian? I can't tell which.
Well, he was an Italian immigrant in the good old Western days, and he started to make these incredible cowboy boots.
Hey, Paul, you better go now.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
Yep. Thank you. Mike, this week, August VFACTS were released, and not surprisingly, another dismal month.
Yeah, so VFACTS, VFACTS are the numbers, the car sales numbers put out by the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries, which is the representative body of all the car brands, and it showed that sales in August declined just under 29%, 28.8 to be precise, to 61,000 new vehicles sold, which means that year-to-date the market's down just over 20%, and that's over 2019, which was a pretty low crap year compared to the years that preceded it in turn. It's been 30 successive months of negative growth for Australia. So it's not just been COVID, it's been a long-term decline here. Yeah. Unsurprisingly, the real driving force behind the national decline was Victoria, because in Melbourne, we're obviously under stage four restrictions, which means that showrooms are closed. Regional Victoria, it's a slightly different story, but either way, Victoria-wide sales fell by 66% or two-thirds to just over 8,300 cars. So of the 24,000 unit decline in August of 2020 compared to 2019. 16,000 of that, or two-thirds, came just from Victoria alone. So the story really is Victoria and then everywhere else, but no doubt a pretty grim time. These figures came out very shortly after the Australian Bureau of Statistics announced a 7% drop in GDP, I should say, for the June quarter, which is the biggest drop ever recorded in a single three-month block, which put Australia straight into a recession. Obviously, there's a lot of alarm over this. The peak body for the car dealers, the AADA, their boss, James Vortman, has called them alarming and says that showrooms are under severe stress and people are losing their jobs en masse. So there's a lot of argy-bargy going on and a lot of, really grim reading for car brands. In terms of the top brands, Toyota, of course, number one, as always, retained its 20% market share, and then double the sales of its second closest, or its closest competitor, I should say, in Mazda, just under 7,000 sales for the month. And then the rest of the top 10 goes Hyundai, then Kia, only four units behind Hyundai, almost made it onto the podium. Mitsubishi in fifth, Ford in sixth, Volkswagen seventh, Mercedes-Benz in eighth, Nissan and Subaru rounding out the 10. The big brand that really bucked the trend was MG, the Chinese company MG, up 69% for the month, finished in 13th place, beat Suzuki, beat Audi, beat Volvo, wow. Beat Jeep. So that's really one Chinese company that's absolutely killing it at the moment. In terms
What's their secret?
New models, really cheap pricing, and cars
the
that look
MG
okay.
Really.
With a seven-year warranty. Yeah, well, the MG3 is actually the number one light car in Australia.
Yeah, 637 units.
Correct, and it's because of things like Yaris, which are now $25,000, and there are a lot of people that don't want to spend that on a light car, and you can get an MG for $15,000 with Apple CarPlay and a seven-year warranty, and for a lot of people, that's enough. In terms of top models, RAV4. So the hybrid Toyota RAV4 was the top-selling car in the country. So the first time ever a hybrid car has been number one on the sales charts, and the RAV4 itself finished with 4,825 sales. Now, if the Toyota RAV4 was just a car brand in and of itself, it would have been the number three car brand in the market. So there were more RAV4s sold than every single Hyundai sold for the entire month around Australia. But so
that's incredible.
Moko, what do you put that hybrid RAV4 success down to?
To be honest with you, and look, I'm not a necessarily somebody who would typically be the target buyer for the RAV4 hybrid, but it's just a brilliant car, Croft. For what it's trying to be, a spacious, fuel-efficient, well-equipped, safe family SUV, it is far and away the best car in its class. And, of course, that medium SUV class is where all the sales are going now. It's the most popular segment in the entire market now, with things like Mazda CX-5 also being hugely popular. But the RAV4 hybrid really is just far and away the best car in its class. And we don't always see the best car getting the most sales, but in the case of the RAV4, that's, I think, 3 months in a row now where it's been number one in market. So pretty amazing.
You know, like, really. Toyotas are looking good now. They're actually, as I put in my Yaris review this morning, it went up. They're shedding that white goods image really fast at the moment.
Absolutely.
And they are making some cars that are trumping some really high-end rivals in the segment. And I think it's the whole gamut of things, like its styling, its affordability, because even though that Yaris, which we talked about as being horrendously expensive from where it came from, the running costs are $195 on the hybrid per year times five for your five-year warranty and service schedule. So
yeah, and it's a very similar story for the RAV as well. So,
yeah.
I mean, people are obviously doing the numbers in their head. But Toyota had two in the top five because the Corolla was also the top-selling passenger car. The Ford Ranger and Mazda CX-5 sat in second and third respectively. Bit of a warped list because the Toyota Hilux, which is usually the number one vehicle, was in a period of run-out before the updated model launched. So obviously supply levels were sort of nowhere. So the Hilux still finished in the top 10, but it was well down the top 10. So the top 10 went RAV4, Ford Ranger, Mazda 6, 5, Toyota Corolla, Hyundai i30 in 5th, Mitsubishi Triton 6th, Kia Cerato 7th, Hilux 8th, Mazda 6, 3 9th, and Kia Seltos in 10th. So that little Kia Seltos has really captured the imagination in a lot of ways, I suppose. Yeah. A couple of more interesting facts. Medium SUVs, 23% of the market. So about 1 in 4 of all cars purchased was a mid-sized SUV, just to show you, I guess, how dominant that segment is. Mm. If we look outside of New South Wales, WA fell just under 5%, South Australia by 10%. The ACT grew. So a lot of places in Australia, it's sort of almost business as usual now, outside of the really COVID affected. There were 35,000 petrol vehicles sold, 16,600 diesels, 6,400 hybrids. And if you take out Tesla, which doesn't give its figures away, 155 full EVs and 103 plug-in hybrids. Probably the final interesting stat that I found was it's not just MG from China that's doing well. It's also Haval, Great Wall and LDV. Sales of Chinese-made cars were up 45% for the month. And we actually bought more Chinese-made cars than US-made cars in Australia. And as far as I know, that's the first time that's ever happened.
Moco, I'm intrigued with Mazda. There was a while back they were not looking good. Have they suddenly come good again?
Not particularly. So they're still down a lot. They were only down 5% for the month, which was interesting. And the main reason for that was the CX-30 wasn't around last year at the same time. So that was basically sales that it wouldn't have otherwise got. It's still contracted quite significantly. It's just that Hyundai in third place and Mitsubishi in fourth, playing there with Kia, have also contracted as well. So I wouldn't say Mazda's doing well. I would just say that it's not necessarily doing any worse than its competitors are. But its market share certainly has been slightly declining over the past few years. It hasn't had that double-digit market share for a little while now that it was managing for a period of time there. Hanging in there, but not exactly killing it.
You can head to carexpert.com.au if you'd like to read up on Moco's full report.
And also, just before we finish that, I will say, feel free to hop into the comments there and ask any questions. We're sort of running a constant sort of question and answer process happening in the discuss comments. So anything you want to know, just hit me up.
It's hard to find someone who doesn't like the looks of the second generation Land Rover Defender. You know what, guys? I did find someone the other day. My sister.
Oh, really?
And I was horrified because she's my family.
It's a personal attack, isn't it? Like
it really is. It's the first person I've come across. So, Tony, you were actually at the launch of this car. What were some of your first impressions?
Yes, we were. The launch was, it's a COVID launch, so one person per car. We normally share cars in this game. To see it up front, I was lucky enough to see it very quickly at Frankfurt last year. And I'm telling you, that was the crowd favourite at the Frankfurt Motor Show in 19. And for good reason too, because, you know, Jerry McGovern, the designer, who's probably only made one mistake ever, that'd be the current Discovery.
Absolutely.
Which most people think has got a hideous behind. That's his only actual failure. I would call that a failure, to be honest. But anyway, Defender is only its second generation. It's quite unbelievable to think that first gen went for 68 years, from 48 to 2016, before finally halting production. And, of course, it was known and sold in 128 countries plus. Is probably, as I put in my review, is besides the Coke bottle, the Land Rover silhouette would be probably the second most familiar shape on the planet, to be honest. But look, they had to get this right. It was never going to be a resto mod project, McGovern told us. It had to be all new with a nod or two to the original Land Rover. And they, from my perspective, and after I'd written this review, and I've watched other people's reviews, and I thought I was pretty much in line ball with everyone else that is really raving about this vehicle. And I'll tell you why, because the first 30 Ks of this drive program was off-road, It wasn't as hardcore as Eastnor Castle could be, where they do these experiences in the UK, but it had some very hardcore sections of muddy ruts about probably 30, 40 centimetres deep. And the car was just, it just goes up this stuff without even trying. And where you had the old terrain response dial, you don't have that anymore. Everything's electronic and touchscreen with a haptic feedback. And it literally takes 2 seconds to change the drive mode from mud and ruts to grass and snow, for instance. But I was just amazed, and everyone was, about how easy this thing conquered some really steep rock crawls and some really muddy ruts. And it did it while providing incredible levels of suspension comfort, because you just didn't feel anything. It was quite amazing. And, of course, I think everyone likes the styling. It definitely is a nod to the original vehicle. There are some great features like the skylights, which appeared on one of the early discoveries, I think, and they're a nod to the past. And there's steel wheels on the base model. Interestingly, they'd sold out of the base model, the 110 Defender, which had steel white gloss wheels. That's what it comes with. And we got to drive the S model, which is the next rung up. So a fairly low level model. But I tell you what, it comes with an incredible array of kit, not only luxury kit, but new modes. They've got a wade mode now. This vehicle can wade into rivers effectively up to 900 millimetres. Well, that's quite extraordinary for a car that is quite luxurious. I sort of likened it to the Discovery, the current Discovery, in its leather trim and beautiful design. But they've also combined this, you know, luxury trim with magnesium actual structural center beams, and that's sort of exposed, and they powder coated that and stamped Defender on it in front of the front passenger, and it looks fantastic. And they've got sort of, you know, heaps of Allen key screws visible inside the vehicle. I love all that, because you get this blend of luxury with this sort of industrial sort of strength look. And that's what this is all about. Now, here was the big kicker. So it did off-road like we expected, pretty much. You know, the only competitors would be the Mercedes-Benz G-Wagon and the Wrangler Rubicon. They would be the only vehicles that could keep up, or in some cases may even beat the Land Rover in a section or two. Who knows? That'll be a great thing to do in the future. But what surprised me and a couple of guys that we went off driving 130K road loop on some really twisty and pretty average surface B roads in central New South Wales. And I'm telling you now, guys, we only drove the i6 petrol. Bear in mind there are two diesels, the D200 and the D240, coming. Again, they were sold out, and they have no more, so we only got to drive the petrol. I'd take the petrol, and I'll tell you why, because this thing had enormous grunt. I mean, it's 0 to 106.1 seconds, but more than that, the body control and torsional rigidity that they've dialed into this new Defender, you just won't believe it until you drive the vehicle. And I said in my review, the only people that will believe how we drove this car on the road like a hot hatch are the guy behind me and the guy in front of me that I was following. I was looking at the line it was taking, being pushed through really off-camber corners. And this thing was – it's just amazing how you can offer that breadth of capability in a car that's inherently – a hardcore off-roader.
I think what's really interesting about this car is, you know, obviously I have a Suzuki Jimny. I've grown up with on a farm with old patrols and 70 series Land Cruisers and things, and I understand the relationship with solid axle, body on frame, you know, utilitarian machines like the old Defender was. But you know, there are a lot of people who think that this new Defender isn't really a Defender because it's not hose out and it's not basic. But if you spend time in an old Defender, you know, where the ergonomics were woeful, you couldn't really fit in the interior, it barely steered around corners, you know, people look at that with rose-tinted glasses a little bit too much. And this new one, yes, it's got a lot of tech and it's not the stripped back tractor that the old one was, but I tell you what, 99% of people would much rather spend time in the new one than the old one, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, the old one ergonomically was a disaster.
Because people romanticize it and they say, oh, you know, this new one's not really a Defender because it's too sophisticated and it's all upmarket and whatever. But at the end of the day, I mean, that old one might have had some cool factor about it, but you wouldn't want to spend all day in it, where it sounds like this new one is just a complete revolution.
It really is. The other thing I said in my review is I worry about the actual Discovery itself because, to me, this thing supersedes it. In every respect, because, you know, if you want total luxury, you just go up to the top of the range HSE X for about 136 grand. So this vehicle, the new Defender, starts at 69 something plus on roads.
It's pretty reasonable, isn't it? I mean, that's Wrangler money.
Yeah, it really is. It really is Wrangler money. And this thing is, you know, this just leave the Wrangler for dead in terms of comfort and that
safety.
And don't forget, all Land Rover Defenders, the new one, gets adaptive air suspension. I think this is the secret weapon that this car has because you are able to change these ride modes and change the ride height and the way the dampers work in a split second. Literally, you can go from low range to high in about 3 seconds, touch of a button, and you can spend another 2 seconds changing your drive mode from mud and ruts to sand, for instance. It's that easy. Moco, anyone could drive this car. My mother, who's 86 next week, will be able to drive this car off-road. I don't see,
love to see that.
Well, we should do that, shouldn't we?
Let's get the video together.
My mum used to drive a Willys Jeep back in the day.
Oh, really? So, sweet.
Yeah. And then the original two-door Range Rover the old man bought, which was a great thing. So, look, I have an affinity with this brand. For sure, there's no question, and I probably wouldn't have been a Defender buyer despite the iconic shape and all that, but this one I could see myself in one of these 5-door 110s. The 90 is on its way, won't be here for a while, and there'll be a 130, I believe. I'm not sure if we're getting the 130, but we probably will. But yeah, look, I think they've done an amazing job on this vehicle. I don't know how you'd improve it, and I can't wait for you guys to actually get behind the wheel and give me your thoughts, because, you know, it's just all very well to have your own thoughts, but if I'd love to hear what you all think about this vehicle and how well it's going to sell. I think it's a game changer for them, particularly after the, you know, I don't know how Discovery sold, Moco. You probably know that better than me over the years, you know.
Not too bad is the answer.
Yeah, it's just an hideous freaking car from behind. Looks great from the front. And everyone I talk to thinks the same. And I think people are buying it because they just do deals. And by the way, here's the big news for anyone that never wanted to buy a Land Rover product because they thought maybe it's not quite as reliable as it should be or whatever. It now is being sold with a 5-year factory warranty, unlimited K factory warranty, 5 years roadside assist, and I believe there's an agreed value. I don't know the details of this. Moco, you might even know that. But there is an agreed value after the 5-year warranty period expires.
Yeah, well, this is all the rage now for brands that have a bit of a shortfall when it comes to reliability, reputation, maybe not in reality, but some people perceive the vehicles as having issues. They are offering things like guaranteed future value as long as you stay within certain kilometre distances and things like that, just to give people a bit of reassurance. And look, if that's the thing that gets you over the line, great idea.
And, guys, there's also cap price servicing. For 5 years and 3 years, so they've got that covered too. I think it's about $3,500 and $2,900 or something like that, respectively. So yeah, they've covered all their bases. No reason not to buy this thing if you got the coin.
Well, let us know what you think of the car. Croft's review of the Defender 110 P400 is now up at carexpert.com.au. That brings an end to this week's podcast. Moco, what's happening in the car world next week?
Couple of big things going on next week. So there's the official market launch, at least the media launch, of the new Kia Sorento. company's incredibly advanced large SUV. It's a game changer. We've just spoken about the Defender being a game changer for Land Rover. I think this new Sorento is a game changer for Kia. Extraordinarily sophisticated SUV for a brand that 20 years ago was kind of nowhere. Yeah. So we're finally going to have the market launch of that, and Crawford will go for a drive to bring us a review just afterwards.
Yeah.
We've also got a Maserati event. Crawf, remind me, it's the MC20.
I think it's a mid-engine high-performance sports car.
That's right, the new halo vehicle for that brand that's kind of been in the wilderness for a while. And this vehicle, I think, really is make or break for Maserati, because it's a brand that hasn't really brought out a lot of new interesting stuff for a little while. So they're gonna have a big event sort of showing us that next week. Then in the garage, we've got an Audi A6 All-Road with Kurt. Tony, it looks like you're driving the new Peugeot 508 as well as that Kia Sorento.
I know. I just saw that. They've loaded me up again, Moco, for a...
it should be fun.
Yeah. Look, I saw that 508. I posted a couple of social posts on it. It's unbelievably good looking.
Yeah, Peugeot's on a bit of a roll at the moment.
Yeah,
so.
And I believe they've got a 2008 coming out, a new one.
Correct. Very, very shortly, a new gen one of those is coming out.
Yeah, so. I tell you what, Albors and I were collectively big fans of the old one, even when it was first came out, because it rode well and handled well, which seemingly the Japanese manufacturers always found it a bit hard to do in small cars. Peugeot have always seemed to be able to give a good ride compliance and as well as handling. So I think that's going to be pretty exciting. And we all know what Peugeot have done with 508 and 308. They're pretty good-looking vehicles.
Just need more people to buy them.
It's a shame more Australians don't buy them.
They just need – people need confidence to buy that stuff, right? They've gone for a five-year warranty, haven't they, Moco? Peugeot?
Yeah, there's no brand below that sort of premium level that isn't offering at least a five-year warranty now, Peugeot among them. So that's been a good outcome.
BMW and Audi? Why don't they go to 5 years?
Well, would you believe that I can't remember. I won't put words in their mouths, but at least one luxury brand, and I honestly can't remember who it was, but one luxury brand told me that our customers don't care or want a longer warranty, which made me laugh quite a lot, because I can't imagine what person wouldn't want a longer warranty.
Man.
Frankly, if Kia and MG can offer seven-year warranties, I would have thought that a German luxury brand could at least match that. But I hope buyers vote with their feet. That's all I can say to that.
Yeah.
We had better go. Tony Crawford and Mike Costello, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Mandy.